I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to The Connection. Back in 2014, psychologist Michael Valdovinos arrived in Afghanistan to oversee the military's interrogation and detention operations. Within a few days, he had a crisis of conscience. His beliefs and values conflicted with the stark reality of what he saw around him and the goals of the U.S. mission. Overwhelmed with sadness, he couldn't stop crying and had a profound sense of being a bad person. A quick Google search turned up the words moral injury to describe the torment he was feeling. Now, more than a decade later, he has made understanding and treating moral injury the focus of his work. He's got a new book, and it's called Moral Injuries: When Good Conscience Suffers in a World of Hurt. Moral injury occurs when there's a deep conflict between what we believe is right and how we behave or are forced to behave, whether it's what we do, what we don't do, or even what we witness. It can happen in a war zone, and it can happen in civilian life. Today on The Connection, we explore the roots of moral injury, why it's so painful, and how to repair it. And Michael Valdovinos, nice to have you with us today on the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, let's go back to Afghanistan, 2014. You're there, and as I describe, and you describe in your book, within a couple of days, you're just beside yourself with sadness. What did you see that was so profoundly upsetting to you?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, the irony here is that, you know, this happened, I started to really kind of feel this way about 3 or 4 days into my deployment arriving in Afghanistan. And it wasn't so much exactly that I saw something deeply traumatic per se, as we might imagine, you know, folks getting injured in the battlefield. It actually happened, surprisingly to me, as I was looking through binoculars out past the base that we were at, into the local villages. And what it started to happen for me, it started to bring up a lot of memories. It started to bring up a lot of feelings around what we were doing in Afghanistan, what the mission was, how long I had to be there. I was isolated from my newly married relationship with my wife. And it really started to kind of focus in on really my role in the sort of broader war. And that's what I think started to prompt me feeling the way that I was feeling. I had lots of memories about Mexico because I started seeing sort of, you know, these villages with, you know, dirt roads, people on motorcycles, people kind of going about their life. And in the middle of all of this was this giant military base with big concrete walls all around it. And so it was sort of the constellation of all that kind of started to really prompt sort of further thought about really what my individual role was.
Was it a form of an identity crisis, do you think?
I think it was, because, you know, when you go to school to be a psychologist, you get licensed to start practicing psychology. I think that there's obviously an ethical code you abide by, which I wasn't there to violate, and I didn't. But I think you develop this conceptualization around who you are as a professional, sort of a worldview around how you treat others, behaviorally, what is considered socially appropriate. So you have this identity around who you are, what your role is as a clinician, as a psychologist. And so, yeah, definitely there was a piece of that that was wrapped up in what was then starting to kind of morph into what would eventually be moral injury.
You described yourself at that time as feeling like a bad person. And I have to say, I circled that because, you know, what a profound thing to say and to feel about oneself. Bad, why? I mean, what do you think was driving that very dark emotion?
I think that what that came from was a sense of feeling like I was a part of a larger mission that it didn't take me very long to conclude wasn't good, wasn't going to necessarily achieve anything significant, and in fact was probably doing harm. And so while I directly wasn't causing the harm per se, I really did feel like I was part of a bigger system that was involved in doing that. You know, I was there during the Whole Hearts and Minds mission, which was really to try to, you know, bring about a different way of living for, you know, a huge swath of a population in a country where, from a cultural perspective, from a religious perspective, they have very different views than us. And while we might not agree with those, I pretty quickly started realizing that that necessarily wasn't going to change with our involvement there. We already had some sense that that wasn't going to happen even before I got there. But in effect, I was really kind of trying to grapple with this reality that, I was part of this bigger system that was there pushing for this, and in the process, hurting people.
So how did you live perhaps with yourself and also with this mission? You were there for 6 months. What was it like to be you there?
I figured that I pretty quickly had to come to some conclusion about the way I was feeling. I mean, for a while, I didn't really know what was going on. I felt that, maybe it was depression, maybe it was just some adjustment to that different reality, which there might have been a little bit of that. But I had to find connection. I had to find meaning. I had to find purpose in what I was doing. And, the mission that I was there to do was actually, was a good mission, right? It was on the heels of President Obama signing a mandate to end enhanced interrogation techniques for detention operations and detainees. So during the Bush era, of course, that was a bit more lenient. Obama said no more of this. President Obama said no more of this. And so I was there a part of a team to ensure that we weren't doing those things anymore. And so I felt good about specifically what sort of my day-to-day role was. And so it was really trying to find that meaning and that purpose around, hey, we're going to ensure that folks don't get hurt while we're trying to collect information. We're going to make sure that folks don't get hurt, detainees don't get hurt while they're temporarily being detained. And really, that was my focus. I said the other thing too is I really tried to make a habit of building connection with people that I was deployed with, not just American forces, but forces from, really all over NATO, with my translator, who was there, who was Afghani. And so really trying to build a really strong connection there and find meaning and purpose was really, really helpful.
So it was really a conflict between what the mission was and perhaps even the legacy of what had happened before in Afghanistan and what you were there to do, which was really to ensure that the Geneva Conventions for the treatment of, enemy combatants what was essentially carried out.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right.
And yet you still felt this, even though you felt like you might be doing good, there was something about the sort of tension between those two that really was causing a lot of distress.
Yeah, because it was really hard to disconnect the two, right? In my mind, they kind of both worked in parallel. Like it was hard for me to say, well, I'm here, I'm doing something that felt righteous, I'm doing something that's going to prevent harm. But I'm here as part of a broader system that right outside those walls, there was war. There was real war. There was combative war. And so I was still part of that broader structure. It wasn't by any means ending at that point. I mean, there was sort of talk of the war coming to an end, but it hadn't happened. And there were detainees there. There were folks that it was just really hard. It was really hard to see them. There were folks that were there for a long time, and it was really hard for me to rectify what long-standing benefit this would be for the United States, for Afghanistan. And so yeah, it was really trying to come to terms with the fact that while I felt good about the work I was doing, I'm part of a team, I'm part of a mission, I'm part of the military, right? It isn't just about me.
I think one can understand, and you describe really vividly that sort of juxtaposition between oneself and one's mission. And certainly in war, often life and death, there are those terrible decisions that have to be made, or maybe even very ambiguous decisions that have to be made. But what's interesting about your book, and I think our current sort of understanding of moral injury, is that it's not just in the military and it's not just in a war zone. That moral injury can exist and does exist in the civilian world. What are some of the occupations you think where that's particularly acute or problematic?
Yeah, it's a really great point. And I tried to write this book not I didn't want this to just be a war story and be about, moral injury in the military. It did come about and was sort of identified, if you will, in the 1990s, by Jonathan Shea, the term was coined. So the research was there, the early thinking was there, but you're absolutely right. We now know that this extends far beyond military and veteran populations. And so to answer your question, some of the professions that I think are at high risk for moral injury are journalists, right? Are physicians and frontline workers, nurses, people working in medical settings, lawyers. You've got these professions, like policemen, and public service individuals who are really working within systems that oftentimes ask them to do things that could steer them in the law in the wrong sort of moral direction. There might be accidents that happen, lack of funding, having to support causes that you may not necessarily or may not necessarily align with your moral compass. So these are professions that I think increase the risk of moral injury, not just by virtue of, and I think you said it very well at the beginning of our conversation here, is by doing something that might cause harm to somebody else, right? It's by witnessing or failing to prevent that sort of deeply violates your sense of right and wrong. That's what really sets you up for moral injury.
In fact, you describe, and others have described, a medical staff during the pandemic, where yes, you were there, to save lives and to treat people, and you did, but there were so many things that were beyond your control
That's
that
right.
you couldn't prevent, and the kind of, I mean, moral injury. I don't know what other word to use, but the kind of
That's right.
emotional distress that people can feel under those circumstances.
Yeah, and I think the really sort of insidious reality of moral injury is, you just described it, was that experience that, coming out of the pandemic, I was working in big healthcare and I was really trying to work with a lot of the residents, family medicine residents here in Northern California, who were treating patients who, were passing away and some were living with COVID. But, that decision of, for example, who gets the ventilator, right? Who gets to come in and see their loved ones, who has to actually say goodbye to them over, an iPad or Zoom. Those are really, really difficult realities for young, medical residents who, rightfully and in all fairness to them, haven't had training in how to address moral injury. But this was what was happening on a daily basis, and so I think in those situations, it's easy to see how people could develop moral distress and moral injury. But I think there's also situations that we're seeing now where parents, community members, people who work in news media, they're starting to develop moral distress and moral injury. So I argue that this is sort of an epidemic that we're dealing with. And I feel that we really are, unfortunately, in that current situation.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. I'll pick up on a couple of things that you just said there. And again, Michael Valdovinos is our guest today on The Connection. He's got a new book, Moral Injuries: When Good Conscience Suffers in a World of Hurt. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we are talking about moral injury, which refers to the emotional distress that results from doing something that violates one's deeply held ethical beliefs. As we have been talking, it can happen in combat. It can happen in civilian life. We are talking about understanding the psychology behind this feeling. And again, our guest is psychologist Michael Valdovinos, and he's got a new book called Moral Injuries. Michael, you say, and others have said, that it's very easy to confuse moral injury with PTSD. They have some things in common, but how do you see the difference?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the way that I would think about it is post-traumatic stress disorder is fear-based. It is a fear-based condition. Moral injury is guilt and shame-based, right? So while the both conditions share similar symptoms like anger, impulsivity challenges, substance use issues, some even share, depression and anxiety symptoms. The hallmark of post-traumatic stress disorder is fear, fear-based, and carries a lot of avoidance. Again, moral injury is shame and guilt-based.
And shame is about identity, right? And guilt is about what we do. I mean, to sort of boil those two words down.
That's absolutely correct.
And when you talk about when we talk about moral injury, are there unique And you do say it covers the gamut. Like your moral injury might not feel like or even look like mine. Is there something that identifies what that emotion is?
Yeah. So I think that to kind of answer that question, while everyone obviously has their individual differences, I think one of the ways that folks often describe this, and certainly I felt this way, is just sort of an overwhelming feeling of feeling guilty and shameful about whether something you saw, something that happened to you, something you did. And it's just sort of a lingering sense of like almost like impending doom around these feelings, right? Like it doesn't go away. I like to say it's sort of like a daily feeling of malaise, right? So you don't feel good. You feel kind of down. You feel kind of alone, isolated. It's a very isolating feeling because, of course, when we feel shame, when we feel guilt, it's not necessarily something like people who are really anxious. They like to reach out. They like to talk about or say that they're anxious because it helps them kind of recalibrate how they're feeling. When people are panicking, it's hard to ignore that. With moral injury and sort of guilt and shame, it's actually quite the opposite. It can look like depression. It can feel like depression. But yeah, it's just a lot of that sort of reoccurring feelings of feeling down, feeling fatigued, feeling sort of hopeless and helpless. That's also kind of the feeling that you feel with those elements of guilt and shame that are really unique to moral injury.
Mm. Powerful stuff. How does it feel in the body? How do we feel in our bodies?
Yeah, great question, because I always love to say that the mind and the body are connected. Right. You know, I would say that we already talked about fatigue. It's fairly common for folks to develop sleeping challenges. So disrupted sleep, disrupted appetite. You often see people who have moral injury with anger, some feel rage, a disillusionment. And so the way that body carries that is with pain, with difficulty sleeping, difficulty concentrating is a huge one. Some people have described, chronic pain and headaches. And again, just an overall feeling of kind of having the flu with general malaise. That's probably the best way I can describe it. Of course, people have ups and downs. They go through, sometimes feel a little better, a little worse. But I would say on average, those are sort of the presenting physical symptoms.
I assume you have to have a conscience in order to feel moral injury, right?
Wow, that we could probably spend the entire time talking about that.
Yeah,
it's a fantastic.
Well, let's spend a little bit of time. Point. Yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah. So I guess the silver lining here is that moral injury is a consequence of something good, and I say that because we're all generally born with a moral compass as humans, right? It's a protective factor. Just the same way when folks are really anxious or have a panic disorder, I like to say, you know what? Anxiety isn't always bad. In fact, it's a protective factor. It's a biological mechanism that we're born with, that fight or flight response, or else we walked in front of a car and a car was coming, we probably wouldn't move. We'd just sit there and go, whatever. So morality and having a moral foundation is a good thing. When we develop moral distress and moral injury, it is akin, the way to think about this, it's akin to sort of your body saying, hey, I've developed a fever in response to an infection, right? I've developed this moral distress and moral injury as a response to something that doesn't feel right to me psychologically. And so in and of itself, it isn't a bad thing. To your point, though, yes, I think you have to have a sort of moral compass or morals to suffer from moral injury. Go ahead.
Well,
go ahead.
Let me just jump in just quickly here, because you write in the book that the Latin for conscience is to know together. I also Googled it, joint knowledge. But I think that's a very interesting way to sort of pick apart what does this word mean. You also talk about evolution, is that evolution helped us sort of develop a conscience because we're social beings. We need other people, and we need if we mistreat them, they're not going to want to be around us.
That's absolutely right. And even though that's sort of from a almost anthropologic perspective, if you will, that still very much exists around the world in different cultures, right? I mean, if you look at small isolated cultures, moral injury and morality is a much, much bigger sort of central focus. They operate on a pretty strict sort of way of living and social norms that if broken could be life or death. But I think, you know, with us in the United States and sort of these, you know, more industrialized modern countries, you start to see that fragmentation, right? And I think, you know, what also happens is that, you know, the flip side of not having a moral compass is actually very dangerous, and pretty consequential. And so I think that that's also an important point to point out that, again, you know, think of moral injury as a almost traumatic response to your moral compass, which in a way is a signal of something that's important, is a signal of something that's important.
That it's telling you something is wrong. Either
Correct.
you did something wrong or something happened that really violates who you are and what you believe
Yeah.
in. You described the conscience as the mind's referee. I don't know if it's calling balls or strikes exactly, but I think that's kind of a handy way to think about our conscience.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I think the other thing that's worth noting is that, and we'll probably get to it, is that, you know, I don't want folks to get the impression that you had to have gone through something really significant to call it a moral injury. We often deal with moral distress on a daily basis, right? Whether you're a parent, whether you're you know, a working professional, whether you're retired, we all have to deal with that. It is part of life. What we are now starting to learn also, which I think is really important and folks should really understand, is that repeated moral distress can lead to a moral injury. Just as small, maybe non-traumatic events could eventually lead to something much more traumatic with regards to post-traumatic stress. And so that's a significant, I'd say, research finding that we are starting to now see. So it doesn't have to be something consequential, if you will.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, that's psychologist Michael Valdovinos. And we're talking about his new book. It's called Moral Injuries: When Good Conscience Suffers in a World of Hurt. You write something really interesting, and I frankly didn't ever think about this before, that moral injury can be felt by the perpetrator, the person who does the behavior or doesn't do the good behavior, the victim and the witness, that all three of these people feel both culpable and violated, which seems, again, sort of things that are at war with each other.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's the exact point that I was trying to make is that, you know, it's not just, you know, traditionally we think of it as sort of the Sophie's choice, right? I have to do something that's not, you know, that I don't find morally aligned with the way I see myself, and it's going to cause a moral injury, but certainly also as a witness to or something that's done to oneself.
But even a victim can feel moral injury.
Yes.
How so?
Absolutely,
How
because it's
so?
a violation to our own moral compass, right? So if you think about, you know, let's say I'm at a church event, or I'm at some sort of public gathering where there's a police presence and security, right? And we have somebody who breaks in and hurts people, you know, and let's say we find out that there's a lack of funding for local police services, right? Now you're starting to see how this comes together for somebody, right? You know, somebody gets hurt in an airline accident. You know, come to find out, you know, they laid off people who work to as technical repair folks. This is how victims, you know, can come to, you know, recognize and be affected by a moral injury.
What's moral licensing and also what's moral decoupling? And those sound like things that we do to justify our behavior so that we don't have to face some of the moral consequences. But you do the definition better than me. Go ahead.
Yeah, so you know the way that I would think about moral decoupling is, you know, you're separating your sort of evaluation. You know, it's is when you separate your evaluation of someone's performance from your evaluation of their ethics, right? So basically, who they are as a person versus what they did. I think a classic example for someone who plays sports is I know. He did something terrible, but boy, he's an incredible athlete, and I'm still going to watch him play. I think that that's something that when we see a moral injury and we have some sense of who the person is or what their role was, or if we have an idea of what, what maybe why they had to do what they had to do, we can do a little bit of that moral decoupling.
And moral licensing, what is that?
So I think this one's a little bit, maybe a little bit more challenging to understand, but it's, I think, equally as valuable. So the idea of moral licensing is, I think, my favorite sort of psychological concept to explain, because it's so uncomfortably human. It's essentially,
Exactly.
right? It's
Yes.
essentially when doing something good gives you unconscious permission to do something bad.
Yes. Yes.
I hope that makes
It
sense.
makes total sense.
So like think of it as, you donate to a charity in the morning and then, you're snippy and selfish with people all afternoon. You recycle religiously and then you sort of take a long haul flight without a second thought. And we can go on and on and on and on.
Sure.
I think that happens pretty regularly with people. You think of yourself as a good person, and then that sort of self-image actually licenses sort of worse behavior.
Let me make a 180 here, because I was also thinking as I was reading your book, and you write about this to some degree, about whistleblowers. And these are people who have a kind of moral compass and who stand up often by themselves. Often it's a very lonely thing to blow the whistle on an organization or an individual, and oftentimes have to face really almost terrible consequences. Can you talk about how you see them in this sort of moral injury discussion?
Yeah, that's a big one. So I think, with whistleblowers, it's not just dealing with a moral injury, but it's actually making a conscious decision to take action
Right.
in a way that brings about a lot of potentially personal risk. And I think that's meaningful, for folks in that situation. I think, whistleblowers are, psychologically speaking, are some of the most fascinating kind of and heartbreaking examples of moral injury in action, because they're people who essentially they're people who refuse to morally decouple. If that, we were just
Right.
talking about that.
Right.
So for example, like the way to think about it is everyone around them was doing it. For example, the whole institution was running on moral licensing, and then the whistleblower is the person who couldn't compartmentalize anymore. Their moral compass essentially forced their hand, is one way to think about it. And I think here's kind of the pain, what's so painful about it is the moment that they speak up, they don't get celebrated per se, right?
Yeah.
They get annihilated. And professionally, socially, sometimes even legally, I think, we have great examples of that. Edward Snowden is probably one, but we can think of, the nurses who have reported hospital conditions during COVID. They paid enormous sort of costs. So I think what's interesting psychologically about whistleblowing itself is that it doesn't resolve the moral injury; it often deepens it.
Well, I wanted to whether the people who didn't speak up, feel their own moral injury because they did not do what that other person did. So it makes that sense of disappointment in oneself even more extreme.
I totally agree. Totally agree. And I think that's maybe a more classic way to think about a moral injury, in the sense that, you saw something, that violated your moral compass and you didn't do anything about it, right? And then it just kind of sits and it festers and it festers.
There's probably no way to measure the moral injury of the 21st century versus the 20th or even certainly the 19th century. But one of the things that you say is that technology and the internet, I guess, can drive a lot of this moral injury. I mean, it is a kind of moral outrage machine, but help us understand how you think that really can trigger moral injury.
The internet's interesting because I think, I certainly don't want to bash technology. I've worked in it, and I think that it serves a huge utility and will continue to do so for all of us. I mean, we're on it and we're able to
Indeed.
see each other right now. But I think also with the advent of the internet and the speed at which information is available, news is available, how there are bad actors on the internet, how it's getting harder and harder to differentiate between what's real and what's not. I mean, I think also the shift towards younger people spending so much time on the internet, I think it really increases the risk for violations of, our own moral compasses, either when we see something that we really can't do anything about, when we internalize information and or opinions that we're sort of left to just fester and grow and become a headline news, when we can't take action on realities that we see that we perhaps before the internet we weren't able to just by function of technology and advances in technology. It really becomes a 24-hour at any time kind of overwhelming of the senses. And of course there's going to be good, but there's also going to be not so good or harmful material that people have access to. And those are always ripe situations for moral injury.
And we're almost up on a break here. It also can create a kind of us and them, that
Sure.
it can be a very tribal environment, which I think
Sure.
can exacerbate, this feeling of outrage.
Yeah, and that's really the unfortunate part because, I think, folks stop to think that we're all on the same rock hurling through space at thousands of miles an hour. We're all on the same team. We're all on the same planet. It's the only home we got. But the reality is that we're witnessing the moral injury, I would say of the 21st century, going back to your point, is really witnessing at scale without the ability to kind of really. And I wouldn't say you can't act, but I think what folks often say or feel is that they feel like their actions aren't enough.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with psychologist Michael Valdovinos. And again, he's got a new book. It's called Moral Injuries: When Good Conscience Suffers in a World of Hurt. And that's what we have been talking about today on The Connection. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We are talking about understanding, and we will be talking about repairing the roots of moral injury. And our guest is psychologist Michael Valdovinos, who felt the pain of his own moral injury when serving in Afghanistan. He's written a book about that experience. We'll be talking about some of the generational tolls of moral injury and the steps to recovery. And again, he's got a new book called Moral Injuries: When Good Conscience Suffers in a World of Hurt. Let me ask you about whether you see societal implications when a government, let's say, engages in policies that violate a person's political, not political, but their personal beliefs, or violates norms, or even violates the Constitution. I'm thinking of the United States and some of the struggles that we are having, thinking about DHS and their goal allegedly was to go after the worst of the worst when it came to undocumented immigrants. And yet we saw, as a country, people being dragged out of their homes, children being separated from their parents, and the kind of intense moral injury I think that many people felt.
Yeah, I think you're touching on a lot of the important realities that for sure have caused moral injury. And I'll say that, I think that for decades we were treating moral injury as a individual problem, sort of requiring individual solutions. And I think that we're finally starting to understand that moral injury is often a societal disease with individual symptoms. Or at least I hope part of, and part of my motivation in writing this book was sort of to send that message, right? To really bring that conversation out of just these smaller yet important circles. But you're speaking of just a number of these realities. I think when you think about, systemic racism, right? When you think about economic inequality, political betrayal, climate issues, I think all of those are realities that are really sort of front and center now for a lot of people. And to your point, it's those are all situations where the risk of moral injury just climbs exponentially, right? And I think that, unfortunately, we're in that situation now where we are starting to see just a massive influx of folks seeking mental health treatment for political moral injury, which was something that even a year or two ago, we were just not seeing in clinical circles.
What is there a treatment for moral injury? I'm sure there are a variety of treatments depending on the need, the person, but what do you see out there that has promise?
Yeah, so great question. I'll try to summarize this one. So there's one treatment that has been studied quite a bit, and that's called adaptive disclosure therapy. And it's probably the most rigorously developed treatment specifically for moral injury. It was developed by Dr. Litz and colleagues at Boston University. What makes it different is that it explicitly targets the moral appraisal, right? The story you're telling yourself about what happened and what it means about who you are. It doesn't just ask, what happened. It asks, what does this mean to you morally? And then works to restructure that. What I'll say about adaptive disclosure, though, is that it was developed for service members and veterans. But there's a lot of applicability to folks outside of those backgrounds, because as we now know, moral injury isn't itself a military issue. There's also a number of other really good treatments that are cognitive and behavioral based. I'm sure you've probably heard the term cognitive behavioral therapy. So there are those therapies that are also quite effective for moral injury. There's exposure-based therapies where folks are the central focus of that is really looking at the narrative, the self-narrative of what sort of how you're conceptualizing what happened, what you're doing about it, how you're thinking and feeling related to it. All of these are process-based, meaning that you're not living in a place of avoidance where you're not talking about it. You're actually bringing it to the forefront. You're seeking amends, you're acknowledging what has happened, and I think you're starting the path of repair and moving forward.
Is it about forgiveness, self-forgiveness? Eventually,
It's a,
maybe.
it's about, it's about seeking amends, but it's also at some level of self-forgiveness. And I think, we have to be careful, particularly for folks who are victims, about, acceptance of what has happened versus sort of self-forgiveness for what you could do and what you couldn't do.
You also say there's an existential part of this as well. Perhaps it is about who am I? How do I live in this world? How do I make decisions about how to live a good life? But that can be digging deeper.
It's definitely digging deeper. And, I think that this is probably the one that keeps me up at night the most, because I think everything we've talked about so far, sort of, particularly the treatments, sort of societal triggers, I think all of that assumes that there's like a stable moral framework to return to. But what we know is what happens when the injury goes deeper than that. Right? Like, what does happen? What happens when what gets shattered isn't just your sense of self, but your sense that existence itself is like morally coherent? And I think those are really, really deep questions and things that we have to grapple with. I'll say one quick thing before I pause is that one thing that is actually interesting is that, folks that we're seeing in our clinics, particularly folks who are older and seniors, really are grappling with this reality, right? As they age, I think folks start to really grapple with their meaning and purpose in their life, their own existence, against really the realities of what are happening in society. That becomes a really tough exercise in rectifying these things that are happening in real time.
You tell some really powerful and, I have to say, some painful stories about your own family in this book, which I would like to talk with you about because I think
Sure.
it will help explain even in deeper detail what we have been talking about. But it's sort of how moral trauma can hurt a family. And you describe your mother, who was born in Mexico, came from an abusive family. She fled her family, came to the United States. She was undocumented. She felt some degree of guilt because she left behind some of her family to come here. And she also saw another migrant actually raped by one of the coyotes, and obviously witnessed the horror of what that must have happened. So for your mom, how did her moral distress show itself?
Yeah. So, you know, my mom's journey to the United States, and even before she got to the United States, is very complicated. You know, the way that my mom's moral injury really manifested, and it wasn't just moral injury, it was post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. Right. You know, she got to this country, was terrified, stayed indoors for a really long time, was, you know, kind of ripped from her own culture and her own family, didn't get to see them anymore, tried to acculturate to the United States as quickly as possible. My dad was working 7 days a week. She was alone, you know, and I think that is where a lot of that depression set in. And, you know, as a young kid, seeing that, you know, it's, you know, we start to feel responsible, even if we're not, but, you know, kids always do that, right? It's development, developmentally almost inevitable. So, you know, I think, you know, I took on this sort of responsibility that's, you know, this impossible weight of, you know, I should be able to fix this. I'm not fixing it. And what kind of person am I that I can't help my own mom? You know, and so that was a transgression that I didn't commit, but I absorbed it as my own. And so that was, you know, that was the sort of beginning of that relationship with my mom, who was suffering for many, many years.
And your dad also came from Mexico, the victim of, as you describe, it sounds like a sadistic father who essentially tortured his children, came to the United States. As you write, he considered himself a moral failure. He didn't stand up to his dad. He didn't, I guess, protect his siblings, came to the United States. And then sounds like he turned his rage and frustration on you and became an abusive father to you.
Yeah, that's right. You know, my dad, you know, comes from a long lineage of intergenerational trauma as my mom. And, you know, oftentimes you hear folks, you know, like my dad talk about their parents and their grandparents, not just in Mexico. I've heard this plenty here, where, you know, physical abuse was kind of the way to parent your kids, you know, whether it was a belt or a slap or a throw of a shoe or a spoon. But, you know, my dad's background is particularly devastating and
horrifying, really.
Horrifying. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the thing that I should say is that, you know, children who are abused by parents they love develop what I like to sort of call or think about as sort of a loyalty wound, right? Where, you know, the very attachment that's supposed to protect you becomes sort of the source of the injury. You know, you couldn't, you know, sort of speak, so you couldn't hate him cleanly, you couldn't love him safely. Every emotional option feels morally compromised, and that's certainly how I felt. And I started to internalize that belief that I was the moral problem. Right. And, you know, it's been a really long road, a lot of work. But, you know, he's my dad and I love him.
Yeah. And I do want to get to that. Let me just quote something that you write in the book. I didn't know how to be when I was with him. And this caused a terrifying existential panic and sadness. There were times in my father's presence when I couldn't distinguish right from wrong. I guess he was so threatening, or it seemed like, you know, the times he was nice to you and then it could turn and he was not nice to you. So you kind of lost the sense of who you were under those circumstances?
Yeah, I mean, it was just being on high alert 24/7. But as you just said, that high alert would wax and wane, right? Yeah. What am I being high alert to, right? And so, yeah, it was just trying to constantly figure out what wasn't going to make him upset, what wasn't going to trigger him. And when you're in those moments, there's not a lot of time for self-reflection. There's not a lot of time to start to try to build, you know, who am I? What's my identity? What's well, what do I care about? It's just about survival.
But amazingly and interestingly, when you were about 20, your dad went to see a therapist, and he made a tape for you about, I guess, about his life. Maybe it was a confession. I don't know. You described listening to it in sort of bits and pieces because it was pretty overwhelming to hear what he had to say. But what did he tell you? What did you learn about him?
Well, I think I learned that he was a deeply, deeply troubled, a deeply afflicted human, and I think, and I'm really glad that you brought up the part of how difficult it was to watch. It was 4 hours, two tapes, and I made it through about a half hour of the first one, and I just couldn't keep watching. I mean, think of the idea of being, I like to think of it as the sort of an example is the Lion King, right? Where you're watching, the Mufasa, I think, is the main lion, and then the younger one. You have this idea of who your parents are. You have this idea. My dad was the guy that was made out of brick. You couldn't break him. He was as strong as a concrete wall. And to see him beside himself, just, emotionally explaining, trying to explain why and how he came to do the things he did to my brother and I, is really, really difficult. And I didn't know at the time that he was actually going to therapy, but it was probably one of the most challenging things I've ever had to sit with. At the same time, feeling thankful that he's doing it, it's the weirdest feeling, right? It's the weirdest sort of paradox, right? That you're on the one hand, you're feeling some gratitude, at the same time you're feeling almost this emotional pain from somebody else. It was a really, really difficult time.
But do you see, I don't want to tidy this up too much, but do you see then his kind of moral injury, the sort of guilt and shame that he felt, maybe even coming to America, somehow got visited on you and your brother?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think the reality is that he left his family when he was a young kid, mostly because of his father who was abusive, but also because his father stopped financially supporting his family. So my dad made the decision of leaving his family to try to make a better life for not just himself, but his family back in Mexico. And that in and of itself is a moral injury, right? And then bringing that here, and bringing that into the family and projecting a lot of those feelings onto his family and his kids, wasn't right, but that was his way of working through some of these challenges before he had to learn a more, I would say, adaptive and helpful way to be around us.
And you live close to your parents now.
I do.
They're right next door, essentially, right?
My dad lives about 50 yards next to me.
So, did that help you sort of not just understand moral injury that we've been talking about, but did that change your relationship with your dad in particular?
It has a lot because, my dad's a fourth, fifth generation farmer. If you would have said, Mike, if you would have said in high school that I'd be farming one day or like being in a garden, I don't know, I would have laughed pretty hard. But my dad and I do a lot of that now. And, one thing we haven't talked about, but I think one thing that's important is when my dad made those tapes, he apologized. He asked for forgiveness. It was really hard for him to do that, but he did it. And I think for him, that was part of the repair. Ironically enough, years later, when I'd be reading manuals on treatments for moral injury, I would find out that that's one of the key components of healing. And, while I forgave him, I didn't necessarily accept the rea I accepted the reality, but I didn't necessarily forgive him for what he did. We now work through a lot of that, right? We've worked through a lot of that. We spend a lot of time out in the garden.
Well, Michael Valdovinos, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection, for writing the book and being so honest about some of the struggles in your life. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mary.
You're welcome. And again, the book is called Moral Injuries: When Good Conscience Suffers in a World of Hurt. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection. The show was produced by Debbie Builder. Al Banks has been our engineer. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.